And good morning, everybody. That was an interesting and that helped wake us up, didn't it, Margie?
Yes.
That ID. You're tuned to KCSB, as you just heard, 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara and streaming worldwide at www.kcsb.org. And I'm Jill Cloutier for Sustainable World. My guest today is Richard Register and Margie Bushman. I have two guests today. And I'm going to, Richard, can you hear us? Are you there?
Hear me?
Yes, we can. Oh, good. That's always a good first step for any show. Yes. Let me give Richard, I'm going to tell our audience a bit about your amazing work. Richard Register is one of the world's great theorists and authors in ecological city design and planning. He's a practitioner with three decades of experience activating local projects, pushing establishment buttons, we'll hear a bit about that, and working with environmentalists and developers to build better cities. Richard Register is a busy man, having traveled the equivalent of 22 times around the earth, and that was as of 2003, so I'm sure it's been more times than that now. He's been speaking on behalf of the pedestrian city to save the world. Richard Register is the author of Eco Cities, Rebuilding Cities in Balance with Nature, and convener of the 7th Eco City World Summit in San Francisco, which is happening on April 22nd through the 26th. Richard was the founding president of the nonprofit educational organization, Urban Ecology, and he is the founder and current president of Eco City Builders, a nonprofit organization dedicated to reshaping cities and towns and villages for long-term health of human and natural systems. And Margie Bushman is also joining me in the studio today. Good morning, Margie.
Good morning, Jill.
And Margie is the co-founder and she's, what would you say, Margie, co-founder and president of the Santa Barbara Permaculture Network. And she's here to discuss the upcoming Santa Barbara Permaculture Network Eco Cities Eco Film Night, an event that promotes the Eco City Summit. So let's start today. Richard, if you could give us just a background on how, on your work and how you started on this path of promoting eco-cities.
Well, if you get back to the beginning, it's way back, I guess. My father was an architect. I grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, beautiful country, and right across the valley from me was Los Alamos, New Mexico, where they're busy designing the end of the world.
Yeah.
In other words, the atomic bombs, the hydrogen bombs, and so on, and my family had friends up there who were physicists doing just that. So I was very well aware of the delicate nature of human presence on this planet, you might say, that, you know, we really need to protect this place, and not in the sense of bombing the enemy into smithereens, but in terms of saving ourselves from our own deeds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, somehow we have to figure out a more Gandhian, peaceful way of working our way into a nonviolent future. And then in the meantime, I just sort of looked around and noticed that that automobiles are taking over the planet and that we have this immense population pressing on nature. And then we have this extremely high leverage point, which is the way we build our cities to have even more negative effect. So we basically built an infrastructure that I started noticing many years ago that's very flat, scattered, low density. Housing, paving everywhere, asphalt, running on gasoline, and based on automobiles. And this just didn't look like it made a lot of sense. And I also ran into a fellow by the name of Paolo Soleri, an architect from Italy who had moved to Arizona. And I was hitchhiking through Arizona, and my host said, "Would you like to visit a famous architect?" And this was back in 1965, a long time ago. And, you know, it was her car, so we visited this architect, and he turned out to influence my life a lot because he said that cities should be three-dimensional, like living organisms. They should be much more compact so that you can walk around them and out on the streets and go up and down elevators and stairs and so on. But at the kind of population we have on the planet today, we need to redesign the city so we have much, much less impact. And the way to do that is to cover less land with the city and to have more diversity of activity closer together. So you have what I call access by proximity. You can get to things because they're designed so that they're close together. You've all heard the axiom that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, but in fact the shortest distance between two points is designing them close together.
Yes.
So you can just walk around the corner and get things done that you need to get done. So the solution to many problems then became clear to me to be redesigning the city and the town and the village so that they become very walkable and very accessible at very low use of energy. So that was the early days, and in those days I was busy doing sculpture and drawing pictures and thought of myself as a young artist. But this big looming problem was just standing in the background all the time, which is that basically we're destroying the planet. And one of the major instruments of that destruction, not the only one by any means, but probably the major physical one you can really get your hands onto, is the fact that we designed the city like this. In other words, the city is impacting climate change right now by way of all the energy we use to keep our lives together in our cities. The automobile is the main cause of that problem, along with the sprawl that we've created in getting involved in the automobile as much as we have, and so on. So the whole thing became—it sort of morphed over from the most creative city you could build, and something very exciting and creative for some artist-like person like myself to do, over into, geez, we need a rescue operation here. Things are really going wrong, and it turns out that the best way you could possibly build for a human further compassionate evolution, you could say, coincidentally, is the best way to combat the problems like climate change and coming peak oil and so on. So that's it sort of in a nutshell as to where the basic ideas came from, and I've been working on them since, you know, about 1970.
Wow, so that hitchhiking trip was very impactful in your life.
Yeah, very fortunate. Or unfortunate, because I can't say I've been extremely successful at this, but, you know, it's been a very interesting trip.
Well, it's interesting, too, how in 1965, people were already getting these ideas, visionary thinkers.
Well, it actually went back a lot farther than that. You have people who were building different kinds of communities in reaction to the industrial cities of Europe and the whole idea of building garden cities around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century was a reaction against some of the early pollution and social problems of the industrial city. And then you had people like Lewis Mumford, who was warning us that the machine is going to take over, that the machines are destroying the city, and by that he meant the cars and the trucks and the dedication to running around at high speed over great distances, etc., and neglecting this intimate city of people being able to see each other face-to-face on their feet on the streets. So the ideas aren't that new in some ways. They have a long history.
So basically, Richard, it sounds like what you're advocating is if we redesign our cities for people and, you know, also the natural systems, for the health of natural systems, we can also solve many of the ecological problems that are facing us.
That's right. And in fact, the neglect of that is one reason why we don't stand a very good chance of it unless we change. For example, there was just this conference in Bali that most people read about in the newspapers on climate change. But in none of the reports that I see, even from people who went there, that anybody was talking about redesigning the city. There was no terminology about city form, city design, does sprawl work, does compact development work. It wasn't even as close to dealing with the situation of the city's impact on the world as you get, say, from the new urbanist or the people who are talking about smart growth in the United States. I mean, some people are dealing a little bit with moving in the eco-city direction, but even among those very brilliant people who are warning us about climate change, there wasn't a peep about the largest thing we build, which is the city. Now, if you're dealing with a problem as large as climate change, you'd think they'd automatically say, what is the largest thing we're doing? But they're not. So the level of consciousness around ecological city design is extremely low, and we have to wake up awfully fast because it is the most impactful thing human beings do right now. You can imagine things that would be worse, like nuclear war, that might come in a flash, but as far as things that are just grinding along, making a gigantic difference, it's the way we build cities more than anything else.
And do you think partially that could have to do with when we think of ecological living, a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to buy myself a house in the country and grow my own food and live off the grid and not see themselves so much in an urban environment?
Well, that's the problem I have with a lot of the peak oil people, who I think have very good information that's quite frightening about oil supply suddenly getting scarcer and scarcer and much more expensive and so on. I think we've actually begun the process. It's either a kind of a plateau on energy production, or, you know, just right at the peak some point. If not right now, it will be fairly soon in geological time that we simply use up all the available oil that's there. And so many of the people who say that say, well, let's go out to the country, put up a solar panel on the house, and start growing vegetables. And, you know, wait a minute. We have 100 times the body mass of human beings, of any other species, any other land species around our size in all of evolutionary history. I mean, we're incredibly gigantic in terms of just the food we require. So we have this species that has gotten immense. And by the way, most of the other animals on the planet are serving human beings. They're either food for human beings, or you get leather from them, or they're your pets, or like that. So there isn't that much left of wildlife at all on the whole planet because of us. So when you have that kind of population, and you have the extremely high consumption rates, plus you have this destructive form for the largest thing we build, the people who are the peak oil people saying, look, this is dangerous now. I mean, they're absolutely right. But to run out into the country and to not recognize the city could actually be redesigned, and that you can actually change it little by little at first and then faster as you get used to it. But without that kind of knowledge, how are you going to solve the problem? And then if you do go out to the country, do you really think that if you have a solar collector and a nice garden that your neighbors are going to let you and your family be eating if they're starving? I mean, this country is well-armed. It's crazy well-armed.
Yeah.
And if you're in the middle of a city like Oakland, like myself, where something like 25 people have already been killed since the beginning of the year, you know, or you're out in the countryside where everybody's hunting and, you know, it's fairly violent in some ways out there, too. I've lived in the country. I know what I'm talking about, in Northern California and New Mexico. They're armed, and they're not going to let you have a nice little solar collector in a garden if their family's starving. So we have to actually deal with transforming the built infrastructure of cities and towns and villages so they consume much less energy. We have to be serious about overpopulation. We have to be serious about overconsumption. We have to invest in the future by taxing ourselves. You can't get a tax passed in this country. It's ridiculous. We have to invest in the future.
Mm-hmm.
We have to spend some money on building a different kind of an infrastructure, or the seriousness of our problem is dire, really dire.
When you say that we can redesign our cities, this I doubt that what you mean is that we're going to be tearing down what's existing and then using a lot of resources to rebuild in a green, sustainable way.
Well, you're using resources to build all the time anyway. That's
mm-hmm.
the given. You want to use less as you can. Now, one of the things that's going on is you do have to tear down a city, but what part of the city?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, there's the part that's coming down anyway that gets torn down because it gets too old. It has termites, it burns down, earthquakes knock it down, dry rot, floods, you know, all sorts of things. And you probably shouldn't build in most of those places in the first place. You know,
mm-hmm.
some of them are on top of creeks. It would be beautiful and ecologically healthy to be there. So if you're going to start withdrawing from sprawl development and dismantling the city, the place to do it is where you're farther from the centers, where people can actually get together and have a community life and share services and products and so on. In other words, neighborhood centers, downtowns, district centers. And even in the sprawling suburbs, you could find centers that make some kind of sense that could then get stronger over time and build more there. And farther from those centers are the locations where you want to remove things with every opportunity you get. Don't rebuild there.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we had this gigantic fire in the Berkeley-Oakland Hills, and I think it was 89, and it destroyed 3,375 homes. Well, that's a whole lot of real estate, and they rebuilt exactly the same thing in exactly the same dangerous location out on the fringe of the city. It's so non-mixed use. There was there's not a single use other than housing in the entire area that burned. I mean, it's just housing, and the only way it could function is by people driving in and out of the mm-hmm. city all the time. So this is the worst place to rebuild, number one, you know. And you could have rebuilt in a way that would be like a little European village that was compact, spectacular views up there. And you could have linked this small development of high population on a small footprint with a streetcar system going straight into downtown Oakland. Well, none of that happened. Instead, they rebuilt where the whole structure was not the best in the first place. It was all dependent on automobiles burning gasoline to get there. So they rebuilt it, but that's where you should not rebuild. So this dismantling of the city is not an unnatural piece of destruction. The dismantling of the city can be very systematic and very healthy, shifting the city towards a much better infrastructure.
And what, Richard, if you could give our listeners, and just in case you just tuned in, this is Jill Cloutier for Sustainable World, and I'm joined. Are you in Oakland right now, Richard?
Yeah.
Yeah, from Oakland, California, Richard Register, one of the world's great theorists and authors in ecological city design and planning, and Margie Bushman is here in the studio as well from the Santa Barbara Permaculture Network. Now, Richard, when I was reading part of your book, it seems like you're really advocating for not just making these small changes that support our dysfunctional, destructive system, but a total redesign. What can you tell our listeners, what would an eco-city look like? And you've gone into that a bit, but maybe give us a bit of an overview on that.
Well, first of all, imagine that most areas, even in Santa Barbara, you have several distinct communities within the area that's developed. And you have low-density housing that rolls out over the hills and down and up the coast and so on. Same thing, writ large, exists in the metropolitan areas like I am in and that are all over the country and spreading all over the world right now, by the way. So imagine a metropolitan area and then finding the real neighborhood centers within that and the city center itself, the downtown, and the major district centers, which are like the larger neighborhood centers. Just imagine three kind of centers, a sort of a smallish neighborhood center, a district center, and the downtown. Well, imagine those actually growing more intensely. The buildings get taller. But around them, creeks start opening up. Community gardens get bigger. Coastlines, you withdraw a little bit from coastlines and ridgelines, so you get more beautiful views here and there. While the city is kind of going up, and the neighborhood center then becomes a village over time, and the district center becomes a small town or a small city, the downtown becomes a much more vital downtown, a larger downtown, and a small city in its own right. And so you have people, residential people, moving into the business center. You have some businesses opening up in the residential areas a little farther away that might be a neighborhood center, but they all take up much less land than they used to. Well, now in the United States, cities take up three or four times the land area for the number of people than they do in Europe anyway, you know. So, and they run on about the same amount of energy. So there's something very, very significant in that. And that is that if you have more diversity close together, you can have more compactness, take up less land, and use much, much less energy. So it's a good idea. Now, to really visualize this, you have to get into the details somewhat. If you have a taller building, a lot of people say, oh, I don't like taller buildings. They're sort of intimidating. They have these big cliffs all around them. Their edges drop, you know. Well, you can terrace these buildings. You can have them linked by bridges. You can have rooftop gardens and terrace gardens up there. You can have cafes and restaurants and little shops with great views over the region that you're in. It's not for no reason that people pay a whole lot more money when they get a penthouse because they got beautiful views, and it's a fun place to be. It's got fresh air and breezes and so on. So if you can imagine the city changing architecturally like that, while the waterways are coming back in, the community gardens are getting bigger and so on, then you have some kind of an idea of this transition towards an eco-city.
It sounds like it's more of an integration of nature within the city than having this separate boundary between where we live in the city and this urban concrete-filled place, and then we drive 40 miles to go hiking.
Well, the thing is that the city that we have now has no real definite boundary. It sort of frays out on the edges all over the place, and you go farther and farther out, and there are less and less houses usually. It's kind of the way it works. So it doesn't really have a very distinct boundary. But when you get to the more compact city, you actually do have a more distinct boundary but a much smaller footprint. But then you just pop through that boundary by walking over to where the creek is or over to where your larger community gardens and parks and recreational areas are. So it's interesting because you don't have nature right inside your buildings unless you want to have a little vermiculture thing in your basement to decompose organic waste or something. That's fine. But you do have this distinct thing of a finer-grained social architecture and literal architecture right there next to the natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just just a different design.
Now, what has been the response? And it sounds like for years you've been bringing this message of the eco-city all around the world. How do people respond to you when you start discussing this and talking about it?
Well, a lot of people think it's a very creative set of ideas, and usually it's for somebody else. And the reason they say that is because, you know, my audiences are usually intellectuals that are fairly well-heeled. They're in colleges, they're professionals, they're students in that track, they're successful people, and they have it down. You know, they have a system that is very secure. They own their property in many places, like in Berkeley, where I've worked for years. People are very comfortable. They like it that way. And so they see this as a lot of really interesting ideas, but they take it very abstractly. And they aren't very helpful. They don't join the organization. They don't lend financial support and so on. And I think the reason is because they fear the change. They fear that there'll be some major land use changes. Their property values might go down. They don't know what's going to happen next. But the way I see it is the threats we can see that are really coming, because we're trying to do infinite growth on a finite planet, which makes no sense. The threats that I see coming, I feel much more comfortable actually facing certain kinds of changes in my city instead of saying, okay, well, that's a good abstract idea and carry on. We wish you well. They'd actually, you know, I actually say, well, let's get moving. Let's start bringing back the creeks. Let's allow some buildings downtown that are taller, that have this novel design. Let's don't put money into highway expansion. Let's put the money into streetcars. And all this sort of thing. But everybody says, we're doing okay as we are. Well, we're not doing okay. Absolutely not. And we need to do something very differently. And people say, don't alarm me. But why do we have alarm clocks? So you can get started with your work. You know, you wake up in the morning, you go to work, it's worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
So get alarmed. Do something about it. And here's what you can do. And most people are afraid of it. I just can't understand why they wouldn't do anything so positive to build these beautiful buildings and bring creeks back into your city and make permaculture farms and, you know, all this cool stuff. Why aren't they doing it? I don't know. To me, it's a puzzle. But I think it's basically some fear of change that's kind of unstated. And I'm not a psychologist, so I haven't figured that one out.
Look, it's just that procrastination thing of like, oh, we'll deal with that later.
Well,
when does later come? Well, Richard, I was talking to someone about some of the ideas I read about in your book, and he said, well, will higher density lead to higher stress, like to have more people in a smaller area?
No, it depends. It depends on a lot of things. I mean, the eco-city vision isn't the solution to everything. Mm-hmm. We have violence, we have prejudice, we have greed, we have, you know, all sorts of negative things, and all of us have a little bit of some of that in us, and so on. So it doesn't solve everything. I mean, you can't solve religious battles between one faction and another by the eco-city. If you put people together who have no civility and who don't really like each other, you have real serious problems. You put people together who find other people fascinating and like diversity. Like, I like my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I live a couple blocks from Chinatown, and we have black people and white people and Chinese people and Latinos and everybody here. And I think it's great. Other people get totally nervous in a situation like that and can't handle it, feel that people are doing strange things because they look different. So there are many dimensions to this, and the ecological city is only one of them. I think the most important one of all probably is, even more so than ecological city design, is nonviolence. And but, of course, it's the eco-city is an expression of nonviolence, because it's a city that does not do violence to nature. But in any case, there are so many other things going on. I live in an apartment, and fortunately it's a bunch of quiet people around here.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there's a lot of cultural differentiation, nobody really leans on anybody with really, really loud music and that sort of thing. So it has a lot to do with how people can actually learn to live with one another.
And how would the eco-city... because I know in Santa Barbara is a little different, but most cities you have maybe a high income area, and you know, then you have middle class here, and it kind of goes down. How would it be an eco city deal with people of different economic strata?
Well, first of all, we have a society now that really enshrines getting as much as you possibly can for yourself. It's a me society. Economics are all based on it. I think we need to have a society that says we're investing in the future and investing in ecology, which sounds kind of socialistic in this world that we have now, which was supposedly triumphant over communism when the Soviet Union disintegrated. But I think we need to tax the rich people more than the poor people, you know, and that we need to invest money in a society that's secure for everybody, where everybody has an opportunity. I mean, this used to be what a lot of people thought America was all about. I think it's a good idea. I think the way to deal with it is quite simple. It's not extraordinarily complex, dancing around all sorts of tax dodges and ways of avoiding the taxes and so on, and having nonprofit organizations fill in because the government isn't going to do it. I mean, I have a nonprofit organization. I'm happy to fill in certain things. But really, the government itself, the people, collectively, using their own collective wealth, should be investing in a better future. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. So if there are poor people in one area and they're too poor, you should put more money into supporting that part of town. Mm-hmm. And until people can actually do that, then we're in real serious trouble as far as social equity goes. And one of the issues here is that social equity and ecological sanity go together usually pretty well. For example, in the town that's dependent on automobiles, everybody has to buy a car just to get access to most of what's going on. So that costs you $10,000, $15,000 extra dollars every year. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a social injustice for people who have very little money. They either scrape up the money and give it to the car companies, the oil companies, the car insurance companies, and so on, or else they just are disenfranchised. They can't participate. So the ecological city is a means by which more people who are lower income can participate because of the way it's laid out and because you don't have a dependence on spending all this money just to survive and to participate. You have the money available to do other things. So I think that the social inequities in the poor parts of town and someone in a situation should simply be paid for by the whole society. They shouldn't be. They shouldn't exist like that. You know, a lot of European countries don't have this problem. They simply have higher taxes and pay for social services. You know, that's that.
In case you just tuned in, I'm Jill Cloutier for Sustainable World, and I'm speaking today with Richard Register, author of the book, let's see, Eco Cities, Rebuilding Cities in Balance with Nature. And I also have Margie Bushman from the Santa Barbara Permaculture Network here in the studio today. Margie, would you like to tell us about your upcoming event and then add any comments that you have about this topic?
Sure. I just wanted to say that I love this vision, the Eco City vision, and it's the lifestyle that I live. I live in Santa Barbara, and I live carless, and I still live in a city that has a center and makes that possible. And I see in what Santa Barbara Permaculture Network is doing with our Eco Film Night, which is focusing on eco cities, is hoping to give our city some ideas of how this can be done and that there are other cities in the world that are doing this. And to help promote this upcoming conference in San Francisco in April, that Richard Register is the convener, and we want to share this with our city. I was lucky enough to live in many cities. I also lived in Santa Fe in the 1980s when you could still walk around and stay centered that way and live without an automobile. And I also, in my 20s, went to Switzerland for a year and had this wonderful experience of living in a village that had a center and that you could walk everywhere, and then you could get on trails and be in the Alps and to the country. And then when you wanted to go to Geneva, you got on a scenic train that took you through some of the most beautiful scenery. One of the ideas about keeping sprawl contained or your cities centered is that then you leave your wildlands free. And we would go down in the train to Geneva. I would get off the train and walk across the street to a pension where I knew the two ladies that owned it, and they always welcomed me. And it's a beautiful lifestyle, and it was a beautiful, thriving city that I visited. It wasn't that all the things that we want and enjoy weren't there. They were there. And so with our Eco Film Night, which is February 21st, we'll be showing three films about eco cities or promoting the idea. And one will be promoting this upcoming Eco City Summit in San Francisco with Richard Register and others. And another one will be a film called The Convenient Truth, Urban Solutions from Curitiba, Brazil. And that focuses on a city that 30 years ago began implementing some of these ideas for a more livable city and very innovative ideas. And they had a large population. They have a large population, many, many problems, no budget. And the mayor at that time, Jamie Lerner, he is challenging us now, saying, why haven't the rest of us moved forward and begin adopting some of these ideas? We'll also be showing a film by Mark Lakeman of the City Repair Project in Portland. And Mark Lakeman has been to Santa Barbara many times, and people know some of his ideas about how to redesign the grid structure so that the typical American city can be turned into a vital, what he calls a vital social commons.
That sounds wonderful, Margie. And what are the dates again? February 21st?
The date is Thursday, February 21st, and that is at the downtown Santa Barbara Public Library for a donation of $5. And for more information, you can visit our website, always for our events, and that's www.sbpermaculture.org.
Great. Thank you. And Richard, could you tell us a bit about are there examples of eco-cities that exist now in the world today?
Well, it's an interesting question because there are little bits and pieces everywhere. A lot of it is very old because much of what makes sense in terms of ecological city design is pedestrian design. And we've had cities now for 4,400 years approximately, you know. And through only a little more than 100 years of that have automobiles been prevalent. I mean, they weren't even prevalent in the beginning of the 20th century. But you might say that only for the last, 50 to 80 years, say, they've really been dominant. So a lot of the older cities have many elements of ecological city design that work out really well. You can walk around centers of most European cities and Southeast Asian cities very easily. A lot of them have been partially destroyed or in some cases totally destroyed for new development at single-use business centers. But where you can find the old city cores, they're pretty good walkable areas, which I think is key. Then you have Curitiba, Brazil, which was just mentioned, and they there have a transportation system that works with a higher-density city. They have five long arms of dedicated busways that lead out from a highly pedestrian center of the city. They have something like 27 blocks of pedestrian streets in and around the downtown. And then they have these five long arms of dedicated busways where the cars don't go. Dedicated means they're dedicated to buses only and emergency vehicles. But you can't just drive down these streets. And along these streets, right, going out from downtown, they're very tall buildings. So the people actually live very close to transit, and transit's very cheap. It enables people from all over the city to get places very rapidly and very inexpensively. So the place has thrived since 1972 when they first started doing that, organizing this ecological city way of building. So there are many examples there that are very good. Portland, Oregon's headed in that direction in many ways. Some ancient cities like Kathmandu, I was in Kathmandu, Nepal, a few months ago. They have pedestrian centers that go way back in time. There are some totally car-free cities in the world, like Venice, Italy, Zermatt, Switzerland. You can only get there by train, and they have little electric carts. They don't really have cars. There's a town called Gulangyu. It's a colonial enclave that's on an island off of Xiamen, China. So there are these places around the world like that. And then there's the technologies that fit. There's the solar energy, wind energy makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of good ideas out there expressed in various kinds of community gardens that are being built. Permaculture itself, by the way, operates on exactly the same principles, as far as I can see, as ecological city design. I'm surprised that as few people have come over, you might say, to eco-city designing from permaculture design, because it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a convoluted edge that gives you all sorts of diversity close together. You have a one system producing many positive results, so you work with those systems preferentially. You know, like your chickens not only give you eggs, but they can keep your house warm at night if you have an attached solar greenhouse with a chicken coop in it. And they'll clean out a lot of the grubs that are attacking your vegetables. So you can design things, you can design cities, so they have multiple benefits from any particular element depending upon the way they're laid out.
That's what I thought when I was reading about your mixed-use building, and I thought, oh, it's stacking functions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many parallels between permaculture and ecological cities. In fact, in almost all the conferences I've ever taken part in organizing, I've invited permaculture people to be part of it. So, you know, I keep working at the connection. Another connection I keep working at is the peak oil people, and I'm thoroughly puzzled why people like Richard Heinberg, who's written many very good books on the peak oil situation, will never mention urban redesign. He just never mentions it. And yet, here you are in urban design, dealing with the largest thing in a way that's very permaculture-like, and that actually could have immense effect in reducing the amount of fuel we burn up.
Well, do you think, Richard, it could have something to do? Maybe it's just too overwhelming for people to even think. It seems like such a huge task to me that maybe people just get overwhelmed when they look at it and then kind of avert their eyes and move on to another topic or something.
Well, you know, that's the theory I hear a lot, but I think that's part of it. You know, it is big. The city is big. You look out there and you go, God, how can I fix that? But there's another way of looking at it, too, which is that in their neighborhoods, people are very active in reshaping the city, either preventing it from happening or actually promoting changes to happen. It depends on where they are and what they want to do. For example, the so-called NIMBYs, the not-in-my-backyard people in most established neighborhoods, don't want to see anything new built, even if it would mean that there's more housing for lower-income people, which maybe they don't want the people there. Maybe they don't want the density. Maybe they just don't like the taller buildings. But for whatever reason, you have people saying no to that, and they're very sophisticated, and they're affecting the way things are built. Then you have other whole communities that invite developers in because they want the jobs, they want the money, they see the prosperity around the corner. So it's different in different places. But what's important is to say, well, how do you configure this thing so it requires so much less energy and takes up less land, and those issues are faced straight away. I think the real problem isn't that people don't understand how to do it, because they go down to City Hall and they do it.
Mm-hmm.
The professionals in City Hall, they know how to do it. They're the planners. The activists who want to stop power plants or who want to stop development in their neighborhood or who want to actually invite development in where that's going on in some places, they know the rules and they participate. So to say we can't change the city is basically saying, well, I'm nervous about this particular kind of city you're talking about. I'm worried that there'll be substantial change. Well, substantial change is coming whether you like it or not. You can see it playing out right now in South Africa, where they're having rolling blackouts that are closing mines and offices are shutting down and electric security fences are going off, so the burglaries are going up. Potholes are appearing all over the streets because they can't maintain the streets anymore. So the energy crisis is beginning to hit there, and it could sweep the whole world. So it's going to happen to us. For me, the inactivity of not facing what we need to redesign is far more frightening than saying, "Hey, let's get in here and try something new, and you know, let's think about it a little bit." But most people don't even want to think about it.
Do you feel, Richard, that it's possible to create cities that would run entirely on renewable energy?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, it sounds glib, but I absolutely do. We have to invest in it, though. In 1971, which was coincidentally the year that oil production peaked in the United States, I was interviewing for a Los Angeles Times article on solar energy a fellow by the name of Aidan Meinel, who was living in Tucson, Arizona, and he was proposing power plants that he called energy farms, solar energy farms, to deliver electricity to cities and towns and villages or whatever. But in any case, he was saying that, you know, if we're going to switch to renewables, we have to invest a lot of the energy from our oil in doing that, because it's a very diffuse energy source we're gathering together. The sun's lighting on the surface, and there's a lot of energy in total, but you have to actually build the infrastructure of the solar society or the solar city, whatever you want to call it. You have to actually put the glass out on the ground, the reflectors and the technology, gather up all that energy and so on. Well, the geology and the biology of the planet has done that for us for 150 million years and left it in these deposits were burning up very, very rapidly. And if we don't use some of that, he was saying, to build the the renewable energy infrastructure, we're going to be in very bad shape at some point. Well, it's now 35 years later, it's that point, yeah? And we better get busy with it because we have not built the foundation and we're running out of time. So that sounds kind of negative, but on the positive side, you can say, hey, look at all the billions of dollars still going into building this highway. Look at all the money going into all that asphalt, which is another oil product that's going to go away. Why are we doing that? You know, spend the money on Amtrak. You know, Amtrak gets about 1/50th as much money as the highway system in this country. And the Amtrak,
I can tell by how late they are all the time.
Well, it's not their fault.
I know.
You know? I mean, you
don't
give them any money. How are they going to run a decent system? I mean, it's not... We're subsidizing, quietly subsidizing massively the automobile and building it free infrastructure with tax dollars. And then they say, oh, well, you're going to have to run Amtrak without any, you know, absolute minimum tax assistance. Come on, you know, you're building the highway system for free, essentially, using tax money to do it. So, you know, get real about where the money's going, and you could take this giant fire hose that's going in exactly the wrong direction of money, just pouring out this fire hose, and that stream of energy could be shifted over to putting streetcars on the streets, to buildings of mixed use that are really quite fanciful and wonderful, rooftop gardens and terraces and bridges between the buildings and pedestrian areas that are wonderful to walk around. And, you know, why not just do that? Mm-hmm. But we're not. But we could. And we may still have some time, but we're not going to have forever. We're just not going to have forever. It's time is coming when the choices are getting narrower.
Yes, definitely. The one thing I enjoyed reading about your vision for the eco city was the world without cars, or just designing cities that are pedestrian friendly and not designed for machines, for cars. Could you elaborate a bit on that? And I did have a question. Do you think there is a place for the personal automobile in
no.
an eco city?
Absolutely not.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's interesting you bring it up in the way you bring it up, which is in the sense of what you're designing. You know, can we design a city for no cars? Well, you know, they all were designed for no cars for 4,400 years, for God's sake. You know, of course you can design cities for no cars. they've almost always been that way until very recently. So anyway, that's sort of a preliminary, but the design parameters you get into with the car are radically different from the design parameters for a human being. The difference is this. The car weighs 30 times as much. Imagine one person in a room. Imagine a sort of a small room in your house. And stuffing 30 people in there, you know? 30 times as many people. So the average car weighs about 30 times as much as a human being. It goes 10 times as fast. And it takes up about 60 times the volume, standing still, much less when it's moving, where, you know, that speed, the ratio of speed of 10 to 1, means that when it's moving, it needs vast areas between the cars and that sort of thing. So here you have a design parameter that is absolutely gargantuan, and you're trying to build cities around that. And you get into the city hall, and they say, well, we're not going to let you build this apartment house unless you have so many parking places. You know, just going to design it for cars. And we're not going to let this development happen out there unless you build all this big highway out there that covers, has interchanges and involves thousands and thousands of acres of asphalt. I mean, this is a crazy system that we've gotten used to. It's gotten worse and worse gradually. I remember during the Vietnam War era, a psychiatrist friend of mine had a lecture he gave called Habituation to Escalation. It's about the psychology of getting used to things that escalate. The slow change goes on, you adjust. The slow change goes on, you adjust. And we've adjusted to this car reality to the point where the car is a more important factor in laying out the city than the people are. And so this has to change. It just has to change. It's become literally an inhuman city. Literally, it's a city designed for cars, which are machines, which are not human. So it's categorically an inhuman city.
Yeah, I go on walks a lot through Santa Barbara, and just walking along these, I thought, I always have this vision, because I've been an anti-car activist, I've written a lot about it in the past, and I always imagine how quiet and wonderful the air would be, clean, it would be so quiet if these cars weren't zooming about all around town, especially on State Street. Margie, do you remember when there was a movement to make State Street a car-free zone?
Yes, and that movement, I guess, from reading recent letters to the editor, is starting up again. And again, after we went to a recent international permaculture conference in Croatia, I came back convinced that we should do it, that we had been to a small city called Ljubljana in Slovenia, and it's about the size of Santa Barbara, and their downtown activity with no cars is so active and so alive and going until 12 o'clock at night, and there's no lack of business or no lack of people willing to be a part of that. It's very beautiful to see.
I think that was the concern, that business, they would lose money without cars, which doesn't make sense to me because you can really stop and enjoy things if you're not moving at 40 miles an hour up and down the street. Richard, have you been to many cities now? It sounds like in Europe a lot, but in the U.S. that are starting to design for people and not for the automobile?
Well, you have very small areas. It's a struggle. It's really a super struggle to get a city to consider, you know, cutting back on parking and so on and designing for pedestrians. It's happening here and there in scattered ways. It's nothing that I know that's absolutely gigantic in that regard. Some cities like Portland are adding density and places that become very pedestrian, but I'm not even aware of a car-free area there except for, you know, the various plazas, which are a really nice idea. But to actually clear the streets around the plazas and back a couple of blocks, I'm not aware of any place in the United States that's happening.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, it should. And about 10 years ago or 15 years ago, Amsterdam was embarked on a plan to expand the car-free area, and they started expanding it, and the people with the cars started screaming, and then they stopped expanding it and shrunk back a little bit. And there are European cities that do have some car-free areas in them, and as I mentioned, Curitiba, Brazil has 27 blocks of car-free streets. But 27 is nothing compared to the tens of thousands of blocks they have in Curitiba, Brazil. So no one has made the real commitment to roll back sprawl, but that's exactly what we need. We need to see it as something that happens in the centers for the car-free, really livable, beautiful spots in your city. And we need to see that on the fringes of the city where when the suburban sprawl infrastructure starts to disintegrate, you know, when the individual houses get termites and things, you don't rebuild in the same places. And financial mechanism to buy those people out and encouragement for them to move into the city and into the villages and the towns. And that can be a very wonderful thing to do at a certain point in your life anyway. Your kids grow up and go away, you know, and time goes by. There's a time to take to live in a smaller place. So it's a really good time to move.
Mm-hmm. Richard, I wondered if you could take a moment to describe the upcoming EcoCity World Summit, which is the seventh, and if you could also let us know if there were any past conferences that were particularly memorable.
Well, we've now had six of these conferences, and the first one was very memorable because it was the first. It was very exciting, and the whole idea here is to explore ecological city design and planning and governance and activism in the city and how to bring nature back into the city and how to utilize permaculture principles, among other things. We've always been interested not only in the city but the village, because the village can become a symbol of a walkable environment. Of course, it's very small, so that makes it a little bit easier to get a lot of variety close together with your general store, your post office, your little bed and breakfast, and so on. A hardware store, those can all be within a very short distance in a village, though American villages aren't built that way. They're strip villages usually with cars going way up and down the strip, and they don't look anything like the traditional village in Europe. But in any case, we look at cities, we look at villages. Probably the most memorable one was the most radically different one, which was in Senegal in a village called Yoff, where we were dealing with villages and cities at the same time. It's right next to Dakar, by the way. We had the Dakar Senegal National Conference Center at our disposal there. So it was, you know, in buildings that look like modern buildings almost anywhere else in the world. But we were staying in a village, living a village life for about a month in a place that speaks Wolof and French. And English usually had to be translated. And it's polygamous and it's Muslim. And very, very different. It's very exciting that people are looking at the same principles of organization of a built community there as they would be in, say, China, where we had the fifth one, or India, where we had the sixth one, or Brazil, where we had the third one, or the fourth one, rather. But in any case, they've been these events that look at the structure of the city, the architecture of the city, the relationship to agriculture, the food base, the relationship to energy and transportation. So we have looked at cities run by solar energy, connected by rail, in which you're restoring the creek systems and expanding the community gardens, all this sort of thing. And that's the kind of thing we're going to be doing again on April 22nd through April 26th in San Francisco. And we have some of the real leaders in the world. The fellow who actually was responsible for the Curitiba changes more than anybody else is Jaime Lerner. And he's going to be our keynote speaker. There's a fellow named Jeff Kinworthy from Perth, Australia, who's probably the most knowledgeable scholar on urban form and its impacts on climate and energy and how cities work or don't work with cars and transit and bicycles and so on. So his name's Jeff Kinworthy. We have the head of planning for the city of Freiburg, which some people think is the European best model for an eco-city. We have local people who are very activists in the San Francisco and Oakland area. We have a solar energy power plant visionary that's going to be speaking. We have the author of a book called Renewable City, coming from Australia again. His name is Peter Droge. It's just a lot of really good people.
Sounds great.
Any particular subjects you're interested in, I could tell you who's coming.
Richard, can you give the dates for this again? And how would people, if they wanted to sign up, is there still space in the upcoming conference and summit?
Yeah, sure. We have a webpage with a lot of really good information. It's called ecocityworldsummit.org. So we're calling this the EcoCity World Summit because we've been all over the world now with these six earlier conferences. And the first one is in Berkeley, so we're coming back to the Bay Area. And the others have been in Australia, Senegal, Brazil, China, and India. And we have people coming from all those places to be part of the conference.
And can people attend? Should they attend for the whole 4 days, or is this something you can do day by day, or how does that work?
You can do it day by day. We also are posting right about now the interim program. It's just finally shaping up to where we have at least 95% of all the speakers and moderators chosen and a time for them to speak. As I'm talking to you right now, I'm looking at this chart with all these hundreds of names on it. We'll be having over 200 speakers and moderators put together in the main section of the conference, which runs for 3 days, and then we have 2 days of academic sessions where people we don't know that well have written in, and they have papers, and they want to present. And those days are the 22nd and 23rd of April. And then the main section has 150 speakers, and that's 3 days, April 24th through 26th.
That sounds incredible. What a feat to pull this off.
That hasn't been pulled off yet. We're still working on it. It's 2 months out, 2 months and 2 weeks, so we'll know how it does. No, I'm sure it'll be very, very exciting.
Oh, that's great. And Margie, would you like to announce again the upcoming Eco Film Night that you're doing to support this Eco City World Summit?
Sure. And I would like to encourage all the listeners to gather up your friends and encourage them to come to this event and also to look at the website that Richard just mentioned, because we can have an influence on our city planners and those that are helping us plan for the future. We have a local think tank called For the Future here in Santa Barbara, and they entertain those ideas. And we can all be doing that because our planners who are planning our future need us to weigh in and let them know how we feel about the way the cities are being planned. But our event is an eco-film night. We do these throughout the year, and this one is called Eco-Cities, Ecological and Sustainable City Design. We'll be showing three films. One will be to promote the Eco-City World Summit. And then the second one, A Convenient Truth, Urban Solutions from Curitiba, Brazil. And this film we've been given permission to use by the filmmakers, and we want to give credit to them. It's a film by Giovanni Vaz del Bello. And do a Google search for A Convenient Truth, Urban Solutions from Curitiba. It has many solutions for city planners, and maybe you could purchase a copy for someone you know that is in city planning. And we thank them for that. And then the last one is City Repair. It's by visionary architect Mark Lakeman, and this, the work he's done in Portland, Oregon. And that event will be Thursday, February 21st at the downtown Santa Barbara Public Library Faulkner Gallery. And we hope to see you there. And our website is sbpermaculture.org, and you can go there for more information.
That's great. Thanks, Margie. And Richard, I would love it, too, if you would give some contact information for just you in general and your nonprofit as well.
Okay. It's ecocity@igc.org is the way you'd connect with us by email. ecocity@igc.org. That's our email. And then the website is ecocitybuilders.org.
And Richard, could you leave us with what are some words of advice that you could give to our listeners about how they could begin to create an eco city, a green city in their own town as they're listening right now?
Well, I'd suggest, I mean, this will sound horribly self-serving, but nobody reads my books to speak of. I mean, it's all there. I've done the best I can in my books, so that's the first step. You have to actually think about these things. Most people don't want to think about them. To me, it's fun to think about them. It makes me feel responsible. I'm dealing with the future for my kids and things. And it's. I draw 130 pictures in the book. You know, it's got lots of pictures. I love doing the drawings.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
So my suggestion is just start learning about it as the first step, because if you don't have some idea of where you're going, it's hard to put all these things in order. And it does help put things in order, like permaculture, in relation to city design. I mean, the two are same principles. People should know that. Nobody knows that. Mm-hmm. And where you find that sort of thing out, the best of my ability, is in my book. So.
And what book would be the best book to start with?
It's called Eco Cities, Rebuilding Cities in Balance with Nature. And that's the one that came out in 2006. That's about a year and a few weeks old, basically. And it's from New Society Publishers.
Great. Thank you so much, Richard. And I had one last question. I read on your blog that, and I don't know if this is still alive, but you had a seedling that was growing on your windowsill whose parent is the oldest living thing in the world, which was 4,500 years old. What is that seedling?
4,700 years old.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's the baby of the Methuselah tree. It's a seedling from the Methuselah tree up in the White Mountains, which is the oldest known living thing on the planet. So it's kind of exciting. One of the interesting things is you look at this tree and you say its parent lived back when they first started building cities. It was born the same century, essentially. What will this little plant look back onto into the future? In 200 years, we won't have any oil. We won't have any coal in 300 years. You know, how are we going to deal with that? Well, you have to redesign the city if you want to. This little tree is a constant reminder of time.
That's the perfect tree for you to have on your windowsill. Well, thank you so much, Richard.
And, you're welcome.
And hopefully we will see you at the EcoCity World Summit.
Sure. Identify yourself.
I will. I will. Thank you. And that was Richard Register, one of the world's leading theorists and authors in ecological city design and planning. For information, more information about Richard, you can go to www.ecocitybuilders.org or www.ecocityworldsummit.org. And Margie, any last words?
Just the suggestion that Richard made is pick up his book. It's a beautiful book. That was going to be my last comment. And that he suggests the possibilities of cities that are not only sustainable, but a joy and inspiration to live in. And that's a good thought to go out with.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for tuning in. This is Jill Cloutier for Sustainable World. And we'll be back next week. For podcasts of this show, you can go to www.sustainableworldradio.com. Thanks again for listening. Bye-bye. Have a great week.